This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 11 for Thursday, June 11th, 2009.
I love gold!
Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
Welcome to yet another edition of Out of Line After Hours. Joining me here in the studio, Jason Vines, Peter DeLorenzo. Jason, let's start with you just to establish your voice.
Hello. Thank you. This is our, is it the 11th episode?
I'm not sure.
No.
Is it? Oh, Ben says yes. That means Jason's absolutely right.
We have an official sponsor that we're coercing into paying us money.
Oh, yeah.
Honda.
Yeah. Honda. We've coerced them into, I think we're up to what, $5 million
yes,
now?
Yes, $5
million. Yeah. We're getting there.
For the first half hour.
Yeah. And Peter DeLorenzo here in the studio with us as always.
Glad
Peter,
to
great
be
having
here.
You.
Glad to be here.
Still.
The 500th issue of Auto Extremis this week.
So. Just an amazing milestone. That's a lot of columns you've been writing, and more than columns, all kinds of little tidbits of things about all kinds of aspects of the auto industry.
Yeah. It's been a trip, that's for sure.
And you put it out early. You couldn't wait to pull the trigger.
I've been doing that lately. I just running and gunning, saying if it's ready, let's get it up and just move on.
And then joining us too today, we got to say. Very special occasion. We've got John Mendel, the executive vice president in Honda, running all the sales operations for Honda and Acura. John, great having you here with us on Auto Line After Hours.
Great to be here.
So we're sitting here in cold and rainy Michigan. Here it is, the middle of June practically, and it's
60.
What's it like out there, John?
Well, you know, the weather's not all it cracked up to be. It didn't quite hit 65 today, and we had a spritz of rain, and the sun has finally come out. But it's actually beautiful, John. I'm just gigging you. Pretty much, you know, we have a mean average temperature out of here about 70 degrees, so it's very difficult to complain.
Hey, you guys are celebrating 50 years in America. This has got to be quite a milestone as viewed within Honda.
Yeah, today, 50 years ago today.
To this day. Right now, today. I mean, it's 50 years
right now, this very day.
Amazing. That's great.
Yeah, and about 19 miles from where I sit right now, the company was incorporated, and our original headquarters on Pico Boulevard, just a couple miles up the road, an old music shop, I'm told, or an old furniture shop at one time.
Wait, hold on. I think we might even have video of that. Ben, do we got video of that, what the original...
We have a picture of it.
Or a picture or something?
It's quite humble. The one I've always seen has an old Chevy pickup out in front of it, and that was where the first eight associates for Honda went door-to-door and sold motorcycles, basically, to shops to establish the old Honda 50 Cub.
There we go.
And I know that Honda's recreated the storefront in its own museum.
Yeah, we have. We have we call it Honda Collection now, but it's a warehouse. It's not open to the public, but it's kind of the nicest grandmother's attic you've ever seen. We keep a lot of historic things, and we did. We actually, from the original blueprints, recreated that storefront right down to the water spouts and the everything else in that little collection hall, and we keep it around with many of our significant cars here for North America. The 600 and one of the first original Civics, CVCCs, and some of our race cars. It's kind of a fun place. I think you've been out here, haven't you, John?
I have, absolutely. No, I know exactly the museum that you're talking about. I've seen the storefront. It is amazing the detail that they brought it back to, and it's a pretty cool museum. I think every car company, in fact, I would even say almost any company, should really celebrate its heritage. And I love what Honda's done with all the different products it's got and recognizing the history that it brings up to this day.
Yeah.
They had a,
it does give you a view back and you know, in some ways how far we've come and in other ways how far we haven't, you know.
Well, what do you mean, in what ways you haven't?
Well, it's funny because, you know, you look at the industry today and you look at the original N600, right, that came in, and, you know, it was about fuel economy and everything else. And you look at how the cars have grown, and then you look back and you look at a Fit, which is, you know, could arguably be called the N600 of today. And in some ways, it's a phenomenally advanced vehicle. The N600 was very Spartan, very economical, and very small. And the Fit, obviously, is a lot bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. But still, we've come full circle. You know, we've grown, and then we've come back to the small cars, which is kind of interesting.
What was the small car of the 80s with the flat back?
That was a CRX.
Oh. CRX.
CRX, yeah, that was the, 88, I think, or
86,
something like that.
86, 86, 86 88. My wife, yeah. When I met my wife in 86, she had one. She owned it for 3 years and sold it for the same amount she bought it for new.
Wow.
And I have to tell you, I mean, because you guys are car guys, and, you know, my son called me last May, and he goes, "Hey, Dad, guess what? I just bought a Honda CRX." I said, "Great." He goes, "Oh, it's great gas mileage and everything else." He said, "It's the HF model." I said, "Oh, fabulous." You know, and the first ones were like 50 miles a gallon plus, right?
Plus, yeah.
And he said, "Oh," I said, "You did?" He goes, what year?" He said, 1990. And I said, "Well, great. It's pretty good condition." "Yeah, it's okay." He said, "It's got about 311,000 miles on it." I said, "What?" I said, "You bought a used car with 311,000 miles?" And there was a long pause on the phone. He goes, "Hey, Dad, it's a Honda." I said, "Well, okay. I got stuff to argue with him."
Well, you know, John, you've got that show concept you've been showing, the hybrid.
CRZ.
Yeah, the hybrid. That thing is really cool.
Yeah, that provokes a lot of the old emotion around the CRX. You know, it's the long nose and the short back, and
You're doing a production version of that, aren't you?
Yes, we will.
Yeah, that'll be cool.
And that's when, next year, that it's coming out?
We haven't given a firm date, but probably closer to next year sometime.
You heard it.
You know, we're very now I've started the smoke machine, so I got to give you kind of vague answers on launch. But yeah, probably late next year.
Firing up the Jimbotron.
That's right. Yeah.
John, what about Acura? You know, very interesting product line. Quite hasn't taken off in its history, say, like what Lexus has done, you know, for Toyota. What kind of things do you want to do with Acura?
Yeah, see, we said all the nice things. This is the you suck portion of the program.
Oh, Jason. Harsh. No, you know, Acura has done in its lifetime what it had really intended to do. I mean, if you go back to 86, when Acura was formed, you know, we had been in this country. We needed a place to give people who had owned their third or fourth or fifth Honda a place to go, right? And we knew a lot of them, because of the quality and everything else, were now considering European brands. And so we looked at Acura really as it was an intercept brand. It wasn't really about luxury. I mean, even though it was the first Honda to ever have leather and a V6, it was really an intercept brand, and it did a great job. So its mandate, it's important to go back and look. Its mandate was never kind of full luxury. Having said that, throughout time, you know, periodically you'd come out with just phenomenal segment-busting cars like NSX, you know, which was kind of the Ferrari killer from day one. You know, it proved that you could have all the sports car that you wanted in a car that you could drive virtually every day without owning a mechanic or keeping them on tap for the full time. But, you know, it kind of did what it intended to do. The interesting thing about it today, and timing, you know, being what it is, about 4 years ago, we started on a real program to look at where Acura was and to move it into a space, you know, commonly called as Tier 1, something, you know, aspirational, really from value luxury in its true sense, or near luxury, to something that was closer to a much more aspirational luxury vehicle. And, you know, we really started in earnest 2 years ago in implementing that plan. And, of course, the world has changed a little bit in the last year or 18 months. But we're still dead set on that path. And, you know, great brands aren't built overnight. That's not an apology. It's just the truth. People look for provenance and history and consistency. And Acura over time hasn't been very consistent. But when you look back, starting probably in 99, you know, up through 2001 and the introduction of the last generation TL, the MDX, and you look at where we've gone with the technology, and you'll see some another vehicle this fall from Acura, which is really exciting and will speak volumes about the direction we're going in terms of fit, finish, quality, and really luxury appeal with ZDX.
But you guys have always had good fit and finish. I don't ever think that's been the issue. It seems that it's Acura brand. I mean, this is just me talking, right? But it seems to be more boy racer oriented than more towards the true luxury end.
Yeah, I mean, I made a comment when I first came here. One of the dealers asked me, and they said, so, you know, who's our customer? And I said, well, I said, the Acura customer today knows us for the engines we build and what they can do with them when they put an Acura engine in a Civic or something else. I said, we're as better known in the tuner crowd than we are in the luxury crowd. And you know, I thought after I picked him up off the floor, I said, that's not where we intended to be, but it speaks volumes about our ability to engineer a performance vehicle. Now we just got to add the luxury piece of it to it and make it aspirational. And that's really the path we're on.
It, you know, it's interesting to me, you know, Acura was criticized for so long. And even I thought that the brand had made a mistake of not doing rear drive and not doing a V8. But it looks like the whole market's coming back to where you guys are anyway.
Yeah, it seems like everybody's quickly trying to, at least in luxury, you know, gather up and put V6s back in. I know I noticed a lot of announcements in the last couple months on that direction. So I think that, you know, the biggest thing, John, I think the definition of luxury is really changing. You know, there's been a lot written lately about this. One of the writers coined it the pornography of excess, you know, that says, you know, in the current environment and maybe a permanent change to a degree in society that, you know, what was once kind of relegated to men's magazines from the corner store, the plain brown wrapper, you know, you want what you want, but you really don't want anybody to know that you what you bought. And you know, I think you see Audi kind of moving in that direction, clearly not being a BMW, Mercedes, or Lexus. They're carving their own path, and I think you're going to see Acura do the same thing. I think there's a place out there for an experiential luxury brand that doesn't cost you a second mortgage on the house.
This magazine in a bag on the corner store, I'm not familiar with that. Can you explain more about that, John?
Well, John was telling me when he was a boy, he used to head down to the...
All right, enough of this 12-minute commercial for American Honda. Yeah. Jeez Louise, you got your $100,000 worth.
Hey, wait, I thought this was a 30-minute deal.
Hey, we got an email in from one of our viewers right now, John. Pedro Fernandez says, do you feel Honda might lose market share with all the small cars coming from GM, Ford, and now Fiat?
You know, I don't think so. It's great to see it's great to have competition, number one, and I truly mean that, because the more activity in the market, the better it is for the market. And you know what? The manufacturers are capable, other manufacturers are capable of building very well-built, efficient small cars. Look at what's going on in Europe, and I think Fiat's a great example. Renault, we don't get them over here.
Ford.
Ford, yeah. I mean, Ford, GM, Vauxhall, I mean, everybody. It's not a secret. It's just that the other segments in the market were so damn lucrative for so long, right? Everybody raced to the other side, and, you know, when you could make the kind of margins you were on big pickups and SUVs, and that's what customers wanted. You didn't have to be, you know, it's the old Dillinger rule. You know, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is.
That's where
the market went.
Alan Mulally said today that he hopes that Ford starts making money in 2011.
Yeah.
Are you guys, when we know Toyota's losing a boatload of cash, are you guys making money? And it's not a criticism if you are. Good for you.
Now, when you look at us corporately, yes, in terms of a global basis. But clearly, we're experiencing the same strain as everybody else. We just started at a different time.
Yeah.
We've been able to manage to remain profitable to this point.
How's the Japanese market? Because we talked about it about a month ago. The Japanese market collapsed, even some respects as much as this market. How are you guys doing in Japan?
We're rising tide rises all boats, right? And it sinks them. We're doing, the Insight launch did very, very well for us. It was the best-selling car in Japan for a couple months, and now Prius is. You know, it's a very fickle market. But, you say the market collapsed. The Japanese market has been tanking for probably the last 3.5 years, mm-hmm. 4 years. It's taken a big hit now along with the rest of the world. But we're doing okay. We're no better or worse off than anybody else in that market, and kind of like here in the U.S.
John, Honda had announced a couple of years ago that it was probably going to bring a diesel engine into the American market, and looks like those plans got dropped. What went on there, and what's your overall view of diesel potential? And I don't mean in the expensive German cars. I mean more in, the Honda side of the market.
Sure. First of all, diesel is only new to the U.S. when it comes in. It's not, the rest of the world, as you guys know, some of the Latin countries in Europe, 60% of the market is diesel or more. And they're in small cars. They're not full-size German luxury cars or anything else. So diesel is very efficient and can be very clean and everything else. Our plans to bring a diesel in here were a little bit thwarted in that when you saw the flip, first of all, there's an upcharge for the cost of the diesel technology, just as there is in the rest of the world. It is more expensive. Add to that a catalyst system that scrubs it without using urea or anything else, and that adds to cost. And then the ironic thing that happened last year, at least in the U.S., was diesel became a buck more a gallon than gasoline. So you had this very efficient engine, which gave you, much better fuel economy. But the fuel for it suddenly ended up costing from the same as gasoline to more. And as you know, in Europe, diesel the production of it is subsidized. Right now in the U.S., a lot of our diesel production is going overseas. So it just didn't make economic sense for the customer here in the U.S. to bring out a car that was more expensive with a fuel that was more expensive, even though you got better fuel economy and could get the same kind of, much better service on the vehicle. So I wouldn't say we've canceled. We've just kind of put them on hold for a little bit until we see what happens with fuel and the cost of the technology, frankly.
Tell Jen about you're driving an Insight.
Yeah, I'm driving a Honda Insight right now.
And how do you like it?
I do. I'm telling you, it's 46 miles to the gallon. No matter what I do, it's getting 46 miles
to the
gallon.
I'm sorry, John, the sticker only says 40 to 44.
I know. Well, I tried some hypermiling, and I got it up. I saw 51 for a while, but, sometimes you got to drive like a jerk in traffic to get that kind of mileage, so I don't drive like that. I figure 46
change of behavior at your age would be very difficult.
Yeah. The one thing I do question, is this the first time Honda's had electric power steering in a car?
No. We've had it on Acura models, and, we had it on the new TSX, or we have it on the new TSX. We've had it on other vehicles.
Because it just seems, it's the only criticism I really have of the car is the steering's kind of vague. And, usually Honda's got the steering nailed down just perfectly.
Right. the good news is we can fix that with a computer.
Yeah, no, that's right. I'm sure it's just all calibration.
It's just the algorithm on the steering. And, you know, we had, frankly, we had a couple of comments on the TSX when we first brought it out. Mr. Healy, in particular, lambasted us, loved the car, hated the steering, and within literally a few weeks, we had made a couple changes to bring a little bit more of that road feel back in that we're famous for. I think you'll see the same thing. We're looking at that on Insight as well. But it's a great automobile. No compromises kind of vehicle, and I'm glad you enjoy it.
Yeah.
And try to keep it around the sticker mileage, would you please?
I'll do that.
Stop showing off.
Hey, how committed are you to racing? Honda's always been in racing, and now that you're running, you know, both Honda and Acura brands, what's your viewpoint on it, and what are you going to be doing in that regard?
Somebody said today that the racing at Honda started right after we built the second car. we are very committed to racing, as you know. We've been in and out of Formula One. We're currently out. But we've been in the U.S. in both CART and IRL. We are exclusive powertrain now to the IRL, the Indy Racing League, as you know. And that's not by design. It's just by default. And that's a challenge to everyone else out there. We'd love to have you in there competing with us. But we're very committed to it. We ran the month of May 53,400 miles without a single engine failure. That's the second year in a row. So we're pretty excited about racing and happy that it showcases our technology. We learn a lot from racing.
So, John, are you're probably going to be a player in the new rules at the Speedway in 2011?
We're helping drive a lot of the new rules and a lot of that change because we want, frankly, we want other, and it sounds funny, we want other manufacturers in there.
So you guys are, the way I heard it is you guys would prefer a V6 turbo and some of your German competitors want to go four-cylinder turbos. Is that right?
It's kind of all over the board. I mean, some want fours, some would like sixes, some would like normally aspirated. Some would prefer eights. I think it's going to shake out. You know, everybody obviously is going to gravitate to where their strength is. The good news is, having been in, you know, some of the early days of CART, we know how to do it. We know how to do turbo. We know how to do normally aspirated and multi-cylinder configuration. So we're happy to work with anybody who wants to come in. And I think, you know, the biggest issue for these racers, frankly, is getting the cost down. These cars are getting ridiculously expensive to run. You know, you'd love the kind of field in every race of the season that you have at the Indy 500, right? You'd love 33 cars.
Yeah, well, that's tough to do.
Well, yeah, it is tough to do. It's tough to do because of cost, not because people don't want to. It's tough to, you know, by the time you get the cost of the engine and chassis and dynamics and everything else, if you can bring that engine cost down and make it affordable to people and, you know, maybe you get a couple races on a rebuild or something like that and you keep the competition high, everybody wins. The fan wins, more importantly, that they see a great show, they see good competitive racing. The teams win because they get to do what they want to do and not sell a kidney or something else to have to do it. And you know, everybody wins. So I think it's good for the series in general.
So is the sequel to the NSX, is that postponed or is that just killed?
That's postponed right now. The last round of market craters, we figured, coming right out of May when fuel prices were high and everything else, we just... We put a pin in it and said, let's wait.
Okay.
Let's hold off.
Yeah.
So if it was a Ferrari killer and it's not made any longer, I guess it wasn't, and Ferraris are.
Well, we built that same car unchanged from, who was that, Jason?
Yeah, it was me.
Okay. Well, you know, we never set out to be czar. We just set out to build a high-performance sports vehicle at a third the price of a Ferrari that would compete with a Ferrari.
I was scared. I was scared to death by the car. I drove from Lime Rock as a passenger with Leslie Hazelton back in 96, 97, in the rain in Connecticut at 100 miles an hour as a passenger. I think we were killed. I think this is hell.
But here you are. But here you are. It was a phenomenal car. Still is.
Especially for the price.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that was the key. You know, it proved. And by the way, the other thing was you could drive it every day.
Yep.
You know, you weren't beat to death by it. I still love driving that car. It's phenomenal. It basically was unchanged from the day we brought it out to the day we built the last one. So you're right. It wasn't Czar.
Let's talk Saturn.
Okay, yeah.
This was okay. The greatest week for Saturn dealers.
Oh, yeah, the ones that are left.
When Penske got it. I know Peter did a column on it. I talked to a couple Saturn dealers that are good friends. This was the, as you said, it was the best outcome they could possibly have.
Yeah.
And how often in the auto industry right now are we getting the best outcome you could possibly have?
Like zero.
Zero.
Yeah.
I hear Lasorda is supposedly flying to Paris next week to talk to Renault about Renault producing cars.
Pat. Out of Korea, though, right? SsangYong.
Yeah. Out of Korea.
Sammy's.
Sammy's.
Not SsangYong, Samsung.
Samsung.
Samsung is what Renault bought years ago.
Right, which is a partner with Fuking Motors in China.
Watch it. People might believe us.
All right, reel it in.
Yeah, John, what do you make of Roger Penske stepping in to buy Saturn?
Well, I think that it's really interesting because, you know, he could be setting a model up, which ironically, from what little I know about it, doesn't seem wildly different than kind of the Subaru model. You know, you got the manufacturer is actually Fuji Heavy Industry, right? And you market them and distribute them in North America under the name of Subaru, which is a separate company and a distributor and everything else. And from what I understand, that's kind of Roger's goal is, you know, he's someone else's manufacturing. He's going to import or distribute in the U.S. So I think it's a very interesting thing. And I think the Saturn brand has a lot to offer. You know, it was when you talk about cult followings, it was the originator. You know, it took something that everybody took for granted, right? Delivery of a vehicle. All the hard part was done. You know, the negotiation, the F&I, da, 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 and they made something special out of it. I still remember the commercials about the people crying and the stories and, you know, all the people turning out and clapping when they bought the car. So they created a real cult following. And I think it's great to see someone of Roger's ambition and success to be able to pick that up and hopefully, you know, reinvigorate some of that passion and emotion in the brand. Because I think it waned a little bit. It foundered, you know, and obviously GM had a lot of different fish to fry with what was going on. But, you know, I think it's great. And it's particularly great for the dealers. You know, these are the guys who, you know, by and large, it isn't public money, so it's not funny money with stock or anything else. This is their hard-earned money invested in these stores. And you just hate to see these guys abandoned on the side of the automotive highway of disaster, you know, and show up as a casualty.
Fritz Henderson came out of the task force meeting today in Washington and says his job's secure for the most part.
Really?
Yeah.
10 days at a time, right?
Really? Yes, really.
Really?
I don't think he would have said that unless they would have told him.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. What was the question?
I don't know.
That was the answer. What was the question?
I actually think they told him. He didn't ask. He's not the kind of person to ask. I think they said...
No. I mean, from the report, I mean, you know, was there... I didn't think it was... you know, maybe I'm ignorant, but I didn't know it was in jeopardy.
Well, lots of rumors on the street that the task force was working hot and heavy on a search for a CEO when GM comes out of bankruptcy. And, I mean, it was hot and heavy.
Well, certainly a lot of the thinking's been that, you know, Fritz is just one of them. He's one of these guys who grew up in the same system as Rick Wagner, and we already fired Rick Wagner, so why do we have this guy, Fritz Henderson? I mean, that's what some of the talk has been of what the some of the task force thinking may have been.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, if you want, you know, completely different thinking, you know, pull a Mulally or something, right? You know, go to a completely different industry, get somebody thinking out. But you're right. I mean, any one of us grew up inside the same company, you're not going to expect broadly different thinking from what you've grown up to be used to. So, I guess I can understand that. But, you know, Fritz is his own guy. He's, I think, very capable and very competent.
Well, at least with Al Mulally, he was a trained engineer. I mean, some readers blasted me because I blasted GM's choice for, or the task force choice for the new CEO of GM. And I know he has some strengths, but, you know, here we go again. No, nothing, not even. At least Mulally was in an industry that actually manufactured stuff. He was an engineer. He was immersed in it. And this guy, you know, has credentials and everything, but the first thing he said is, yeah, I don't really know much about the car business. Don't really know anything about it.
Yeah.
And I, you know, yeah, maybe you can get by, but boy, at least have some sort of a feel for it if you're going to be calling the shots.
It does beg the question, or reinforce the fact that, you know, the belief that ritual sacrifice is still alive and well in a civilized population with the, you know, because let's see, I sacrificed the board and Rick Wagner and then took, you know, someone else who grew up in the same company and put him in as CEO. We could argue all day whether Rick Wagner was the problem or not. So,
right.
Probably very few of our viewers are Detroit residents. I don't know what the number is. But the telling article in Sunday's Free Press, I think Greg Gardner wrote it, about how the task force treated the Chrysler management over the last couple of months, just basically tell them, stop doing what you're doing, we're in charge. Yeah. It was a really eye-opening article, well-done article, and had a lot of people around Detroit talking.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of made the guys in Auburn Hills look silly. And it kind of made the auto task force look like a bunch of bullies in some respects. Now, they had a charge. They had to get it done, and you got to give them credit for Chrysler's almost out of bankruptcy in record time.
Yeah. I wouldn't want their job. I mean, you know, the task force is, you know, it's pretty thankless kind of position. Because you're going to end up making a lot of people as enemies, I'm sure. But you're right. You have a mandate.
I got to tell you, though, what was a little disturbing, though, was the announcement yesterday about the compensation czar, who's going to determine how much the executives, the management teams can be paid. And making the announcement was Greitner, a former journalist turned Wall Street banker.
Ratner.
That made $188 million?
Made a lot of money.
Made a lot of money.
I got a real, real problem with that whole thing. That's just bullshit.
Yeah.
I got to tell you.
Oh, I completely agree. The government has no reason dictating salaries. But the only thing I'll say is when you're in front of the government and saying, please give me money or I'm going to die, and the government gives you money, you're on the hook to the government. You got to do what they say. And that's.
Yeah. And if any one of us went to the bank tomorrow, hat in hand, and said, listen, I got to have a loan on my house and everything else. I mean, you know that the bank is going to force you to restructure a lot of the stuff that you don't want to touch. You know, they want to secure your 401k. They're going to make you do this. They want you to pay off this credit card bill. And you're going to do the things that the bank wants because otherwise you wouldn't need them. So, I mean, I understand it, but it just, if there's heavy-handed stuff involved, that's when it gets tough for people to swallow.
All right. Hey, John, I know you're busy and you're going to have to get going here, but one other thing I'd like to ask you about is Sergio Marchionne came out and completely revamped Chrysler's brand structure. You know, they announced it today. They're going to have president and CEOs with full P&L responsibility for each one of their brands. Dodge is going to have its own CEO, so will Chrysler, so will Jeep. I'm just curious your reaction to that kind of a structure.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, it's kind of an FMCG structure. You know, if you look at, you know, Kleenex has its own brand manager with P&L, and Coke does, and you know, it's not unusual. It's unusual in the automotive industry because we've tended to, I think, aggregate things under the parent and not under the individual brand, right? It was, you know, Fomoco or General Motors or anything else. It wasn't necessarily Chevrolet, Olds, Pontiac, Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep. I don't, you know. So I think it does kind of push the responsibility down. And it kind of runs counter to what the industry, I think, has been trying to do, maybe rightly or wrongly, over the last kind of decade, which is this aggregation and accumulation of different brands for kind of brand synergy, manufacturing and everything else. If they can pull it off, it might give them some individual focus to the degree that they don't compete with each other. I think it, you know, it'll change things up a little bit.
Well, I mean, I'll ask you, wouldn't you love to have full P&L for Acura and Honda?
Sure.
I would think anybody would jump at a chance like that, that had that put before. I think Marchionne's really onto something here, you know. Well, we'll see how it works.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with it, and I think it's you know, it's about how you account for it too. Within companies, you can account for things any way you want, to the degree that you don't sub-optimize the whole for the optimization of the individual. I don't mean to get all, you know, weird on you, but, you know, to the degree that you don't have, I guess, damaging operations from one that damage the parent, you know, you somebody's got to manage that, which says he's going to have a pretty firm control over the brand's entirety, or else it won't work.
The dangerous thing, though, is that the brands are competing against each other within a company.
That's absolutely true.
And
with very limited resources.
That's right.
And here's what happens. I mean, having been a part of some experiments like that, you find out that after you bid each other up for advertising dollars, that your competing in-house parent brand just cost you another $500 million in advertising. Because
mm-hmm.
you really, you know, they really wanted the, you know, a certain event or a certain strategy, you know, and but they couldn't afford it, but you could, so you just cost each other a ton of money.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, I guess that depends on how the corporation allocates you money. I mean, I imagine as the CEO, you're going to have to go to the parent for money, and that's where the overseeing is going to happen. And I'm just imagining that because it seems to me that's how it's worked at Fiat, and certainly up until the big collapse, Fiat was red hot, man. I mean, Marchionne really turned that place around awfully damn quick.
Yeah, but your very comment, John, begs a question. If you got to go to the parent for money, it still doesn't control how you spend it.
True.
You go with plan, and you can still drive competing costs up against the two brands. You're going to have some oversight that kind of looks broadly over the shoulder of both of those things. I mean, if you just cut the two of them loose and you say, okay, you know, here's Chrysler, here's Jeep, you've all got your budgets, go forth and, you know, kick butt. It still doesn't address the competing brand issue.
And it doesn't have the synergy of Dodge and Jeep going together to NBC and saying we want to buy out Law and Order for the year. We'll
right.
split it between us, as opposed to them having two different agencies or whatever, calling up the buyer on Law and Order, and you're right, jacking up the price, and they realize they were bidding against each other, as husband and wife at a charity auction,
right.
bidding up a painting and
with
and
different battles,
opposite
yeah.
sides of the room and screwing themselves.
This yeah. sounds like the voice of experience talking here, Jason.
I'm still bitter.
Yeah, hey, Jason, we worked at the same place one time, didn't we?
I think we did.
Oh. Hey, John, I know we got to cut you loose here, but it's been great having you on with us.
It's been great talking to you guys. I hope your rain stops.
Oh, yeah. No, it's going to be a bright and sunny day tomorrow. We need the rain at some points anyway, so I guess we'll take it tonight.
I know.
Thanks, John.
Hey,
the good news about where you guys are is your weather will get better. Mine won't.
No, the good news about rain in Michigan, it fills the potholes in the freeway system.
Hey, great talking to you guys.
Yeah, okay. Go grab a surfboard.
Hey, thank you.
See ya.
See ya.
Take care. Bye bye.
That's pretty good. 50 years in America, that is a milestone. And I didn't realize absolutely tonight's the night.
Yeah, so,
or today's
cool.
the day, you know.
Of the Asian companies, Honda's always been my favorite. It's
I've always admired them.
Yeah, they've stayed focused. And like I said, probably too much, but they don't call it the motor company for nothing.
Right.
It's
right.
the Honda Motor Company, and that's a key distinction.
I know a couple of the U.S. automakers were blasting Honda a few years ago. When Honda, remember they had those ads that showed the lawnmower and the motorcycle?
Yeah, those are good ads.
And, but they were going, oh, these guys, oh, they're just boiling the ocean here. They can't focus. No, those are brilliant ads to say we produce motors and we just have other stuff wrapped around them, from lawnmowers to motorcycles to cars.
Well, the other thing I admire Honda, you go back to their very roots. I mean, they started as a motorcycle company, and then when Soichiro Honda wanted to get into cars, MITI, the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, came in and said, no, you can't build cars. We got enough car companies. You got to do something else. And he told them to stuff it and went and build cars.
And plus, racing's always been a part of the companies.
From the beginning.
From the very beginning, which is another reason why I have so much respect
to the TT race.
And when the alliance of automakers went from being just the big three in Washington to include Toyota and the Germans, Honda said, no way. I ain't wasting my money. I'm not going to play, any reindeer games here. But they were just honest and forthright. They say, we're our own company. We don't need to have an alliance.
And look at them, to your point, Peter, of, all the power products that they're in. Anything that has an engine, they want to be part of it. They're doing this jet. They're doing the jet in the States, by the way, which I think is pretty cool.
It's a very cool plane.
And, they're really pushing the envelope. They're into robots and everything. Why? Because they go, we don't want to just do electronic stuff. We want to do mechanical. So their robots are far more mechanical than most other robots that are out there. It's a cool company. They've stuck to what they've always been about.
Can I do this right now?
Yeah, do it.
Okay. Now, GM went into bankruptcy on June 1st. And as we mentioned last week, we want you to give us your best guess when GM will come out of bankruptcy. Remember, day one was the 1st of June. The closest guess will win an Auto Extremist T-shirt that's been worn only twice by Peter. Three times.
Actually, it's right out of the box.
An Autoline Detroit hat with
a commemorative pin.
Commemorative pin. An Autoline Detroit look back at John's most provocative interviews with himself.
10 years of interviews.
Okay, these are some great interviews.
Doesn't take you 10 years to watch it.
One of these shrinkable shirts that you put in water and it turns into another Auto Extremist shirt. No, it's an Autoline shirt. You get a cup, and you get it. Is this the same? This is what the T-shirt looks like.
I think that's what the T-shirt looks like.
Okay,
right.
And John's BlackBerry.
No, I need that.
So, the one closest to it, so send your guess in. The winner, if we have more than one winner, we'll pick one.
Yeah,
at
what we want you to guess is how many days is GM going to be in bankruptcy? And,
Price have been 42?
We're at the 11th today, so it's, 42.
Or
41, 42.
Yeah. Okay.
Two runner-ups will be awarded two items of Autoline gear of their choosing.
Yes.
Okay. The deadline for entries is midnight next Thursday, which is June 18th. This is the 11th today, so it's...
Actually, it should be... Well, no, I guess it's okay. Midnight next... Okay, yeah.
To enter, look for the link on John's Journal on AutolineDetroit.tv, or just go to bit.ly/AAH. It's Autoline After Hours Contest. And tell us how many days GM will be in bankruptcy.
Yeah.
We will announce the winner, the show, whenever, after it happens.
And, we'll probably have people that get the same answer. We're going to find the right answer and randomly pick a winner, and then we'll have two runner-ups, as Jason just mentioned.
And you have two trophies over here.
And we do, because talking about Autoline Detroit, we won an Emmy. We've got two of them here because my producer, Chip Drake, and my creative guy, Ben Sanders, really are the ones who won these things.
And, very cool.
It's neat, man. It's really something.
Who gave that to you?
And it's gold!
Yeah. Oh, if this is gold, they're not getting them. They're mine. No, this was, the Coffee. Michigan Emmy Awards, blah, 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 blah. We got it. The category was business, consumer program special.
Cool. So, congratulations.
Yeah. No, Chip planned the whole thing out, and Ben really made it happen from a creative standpoint, and they just told me what to say.
And we're getting close to rapid fire.
Yeah, we got to have rapid fire. Let's
let her rip.
Bring the questions out.
We're still waiting. We're waiting. They're printing.
Still
They're
printing. Printing.
What else happened this week?
Well, hey, the Chrysler stuff. I thought that was huge. They blew out. I mean, Steve Landry and Frank Cligan are gone
Landry,
at Chrysler.
From what my sources says, is going to go and join Lasorda with Roger Penske.
Ooh, interesting.
Saturday.
Interesting.
I think that's likely.
Press is staying on.
Press is staying on.
I wonder how long.
In a weird role.
I don't think for very long. Like, I really don't.
I don't think it's
going to
last.
Like he's hall monitor.
Yeah.
Right, right.
That's.
No, I heard that, when they were introducing Marchione and Kidder, the new chairman, to everybody, Jim Press was not up on stage. He was in the rest of the audience and... To me, I think that might tell it all.
With an Alfred E. Newman T-shirt on saying, what me worry.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of people getting burned in this whole upheaval, and I think he's going to be one of them.
Yeah, I'm hearing really mixed reviews on the presentation that they made at Chrysler yesterday, that it was all business plan, and there was nothing really inspirational to say, hey, come on, guys. We got one last chance. Let's do it.
All right.
It was more matter of fact, and one person called me and said it was cold.
Hmm. Instead of activating the giant laser.
I asked for a freaking laser. So we'll see how that goes. They've got some tough sledding.
Oh, they do.
They've got to get through,
The next 2 years, until they get new product in the pipeline, it's going to be mighty tough.
I'm really thinking, now that the government is into GM and Chrysler, I'm really thinking that infomercial's not far away with Michelle and Barack, driving Chryslers and GM cars and touring the GM design and, something's got to happen.
She comes out of the White House and goes, I'm going to my victory garden.
Yeah.
I'm getting in my Wrangler to drive the 1.001 mile.
Well, remember, Barack himself, when he was just a regular sort of a citizen, bought a Chrysler 300C.
And he was criticized for having a gas-guzzling vehicle, even though it's not a gas-guzzling vehicle. And what did he end up getting, a Ford Escape Hybrid or something?
Yeah, Escape Hybrid.
Yeah.
So another thing, Rush Limbaugh leading a boycott of GM products.
I'm a rabid Republican, a believer in a party that's completely lost its way. And Rush Limbaugh is taking the lead, which scares the hell out of me, unbelievably. He was paid by General Motors over the past few years. They ran tons of ads.
I think it's reprehensible. That's despicable.
Is that right? GM was a big sponsor of his show?
Huge.
Yeah.
On Hannity, Sean Hannity's show.
He stopped short of it. He talked around it. He didn't call for it. He just said, it's out there and I can understand why people... I just think it's reprehensible that he fans those flames. He's just despicable.
When he said he wants Obama to fail, I don't like Obama. I think his policies are horrific. I don't want him to fail. Because if he fails, our country fails.
Well, as I've said all along, Rush Limbaugh is a multi-millionaire. He can afford to have Obama fail. He's not going to hurt.
No, in fact, he's loving this now. Obama is the best thing that ever happened to Rush Limbaugh. It resurrected his career. So, but this thing about GM, this is a company that paid you a lot of money to promote their products. And he has a lot of sway. He does, unfortunately. And for him to call for almost a boycott on GM, people will listen. And I think
it's just so
despicable on his part.
No, I think
it is.
Rush,
from our set, take a couple more OxyContin. Just shut up.
Right. And Peter, as you said before, you don't like the fact this guy Whitaker, who's the new chairman of GM, has zip industrial experience, although he is on the board of ExxonMobil.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a political job now, and I guess in that regard, where he came from, AT&T, and he's politically savvy and all that, maybe that's what they need now. But
he was quoted in some article saying, you know, I don't know anything about cars or words to that effect.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Ben was telling me that was all over Twitter. Everybody's just Twitter. I don't know anything about cars.
I just think it's, you know, after all they've been through, after all the stuff, after all it's been proven, you know, we've talked about in past shows, GM has always had a financial guy as chairman and always had sort of a product guy as president, but the chairman's always a finance guy. Here, you know, clean sheet of paper. Get someone with at least a feel. I mean, like I said, Al Mulally was a trained engineer. He was in a manufacturing business. He was in the trenches. He gets it. But this guy is a political operator. You know, maybe that's what they need, but boy, I sure wouldn't have gone that direction. I'd want someone with...
I don't think it is what they need. Okay, he knows a lot about restructuring. Okay, great, but as we keep talking about, at the end of the day, it's about great cars and trucks.
Absolutely.
And treat the customer right.
It's a political choice who can maneuver, work the room in Washington, but I wanted someone who knew the car business.
Yeah.
Inside and out. There was only one guy, frankly. It should have been Roger Penske. Mm-hmm. But he's got his own gig, and he's quite
busy
happy.
With Saturn now.
Yeah. He's going to show GM how to do it.
I'm not sure Roger knows the word busy. He's involved in so many things.
Oh, man. No, it's just standard operating procedure for him.
Yeah. Okay, we got the questions. Ben, let's bring up rapid fire.
Oh, geez, Louise. Spicy Meatball asks, what needs to happen in the U.S. Senate to pass cash for clunkers?
It's there. It's going to happen this week. I think we'll see a vote.
The House today.
It did, right. Well, I say this week. There's only one more day left.
Passed the House yesterday.
Yesterday?
Yesterday,
okay.
Right. I've been traveling, so
the costs
that's
are
my excuse.
Enormous.
Between 3.5 and 4.5 billion.
I don't think it's. Look.
With a cap of a million customers.
Yeah, look, you have to have a car that's 8 years old or older. And the fact of the matter is, the vast majority of people with cars that are 8 years old or older are not in the market for a new car. There are people who buy a car and keep it 8-10 years and go buy a new one, no question about it. But it's about 8% of everything that's out there that's going to qualify as a clunker. So. Yeah, it'll help, and it'll get a lot of people interested until they find out they don't qualify.
Yeah, it's short term, but it's not going to be the solution.
I thought this was a dumb question, but I don't think it is. Hank asks, I'm wondering if the new CAFE requirements could be easily met with E85 vehicles, ethanol. Now, fuel economy is fuel economy, is that right? Does it matter if it's E85 or gasoline?
No. There's a special bonus. You get bonus points, as
because
it were, if you have
15%
flex fuel.
You're only using 15% gasoline.
If they use the flex fuel, and that's the big problem, is the government says, okay, look, we're going to give you guys a credit for building flex fuel, but we know most people aren't going to use the flex fuel, so you only get this much credit.
Because
you don't
the
get
oil
the whole
industry
enchilada.
Doesn't want to provide E85.
No, they sure don't. They hate it.
They hate it.
Right.
Hate it.
They are against it.
Mike Western asks, GM, Ford, and Chrysler allowed their public relations campaigns to fail beyond belief in Washington. What happened, and did the Detroit Three fire their PR firms?
GM, the Detroit automakers took their eye off the ball in Washington completely. I mean, it was such a corrosive, combative environment that was set up way back from the Nader days that the Detroit 3 never got over that. And I think there was about a 10-year period where they basically didn't spend enough money at all. And Jason, you would know this. And they just felt they weren't getting anywhere, and they just said, well, we can, you know, trim that. And, of course, it came back to bite them in the ass, because when they went in front of the senators and the congresspeople in December, and they started talking about a Detroit that existed back in 95, and all of a sudden they realized, whoa, did we blow that? And it's unfortunate, but that was a bad, bad thing.
Intini4 on Twitter asks, what automakers are best positioned globally to survive and even grow during this current economic crisis?
I'll tell you, the one that's really standing out in my mind right now is Volkswagen. They're still not losing money. I mean, their profits are plummeting, but they're still making money. You know, I'm intrigued at how they run Audi. You know, it's a totally standalone company. We're talking about brand managers now becoming CEOs with full P&L. I mean, Audi has its own annual report. It's not this synergistic, you know, you have to share every. No, I mean, and, you know, with Bentley and.
Yeah, they have a shot. Volkswagen's going to be there as long as there aren't any Klinkian nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously Toyota's going to be there.
Right.
Ford is going to be there.
Right.
GM's got too much going on in China not to be there.
Mm-hmm. Honda, you know, we've been talking about this show. Honda's going to be there.
There's going to be a German component. Right. Now, I've said that one scenario is Mercedes and BMW get absorbed into the Volkswagen group, still stand alone, but eventually the German car companies are going to have to be Germany Inc. And there'll be a China. There'll be one China.
At least.
At least one. And then the Korean thing.
I think China's farther off than a lot of people. You know, at Chrysler, Lasorda was talking that China was going to get here in record time. I don't think they are. The quality is terrible. They've got a bad reputation for toys and everything else. And I think people are getting leery of China. Okay. Baldsack on Twitter asked Pete. Thank you, Baldsack, for that name. Why does Peter think Chrysler will not be successful under Fiat? He said on the BBC it looked bad for them. Go Wings.
I'm just fearful for Chrysler. I mean, and we've talked about this. They've got, Jason, they've got two new products. They've got the Grand Cherokee and a new 300, correct?
And supposedly a Charger.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't think we should talk about the Fiats because they're 20 to 24 months away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all agree that the 500 could be a cult car like the Mini.
Right.
But the mainstream Fiats, boy, that's a ways away. So you have a depleted dealer rank, which they needed to do, absolutely, as painful as it is. But they have to get back to selling what they have. And let's not forget the consumer impression of Chrysler products is poor quality. And so they have a huge, huge mountain to climb. You know, when I say I don't think they're going to make it, doesn't mean I want them not to make it. I just think it's extremely difficult.
Yep.
Okay, we're getting low, so we'll move on to the next one. Bernie Filosoff asks, will we ever see widespread use of hydrogen-fueled internal combustion engines as Bill Ford predicted a few years ago?
Not in our lifetimes.
No.
Not in our life. Hey, look, you know, you have to build a hydrogen infrastructure. It's got to be in gas stations all over the place. The world's broke. Yeah. We have no money. We can't build this infrastructure. Not for a long time to come.
Plus, extracting or making hydrogen, which the best thing is natural gas. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's a lot of problems.
You use natural gas. Yeah. You know, what I like to say is you can't drill a hole in the ground and have hydrogen come a bubbling up. You have to manufacture hydrogen. That takes energy. So which energy do you want to use to make your hydrogen? I mean, it's
thank you,
not
Jed.
For a long time. Yeah, yeah.
Jed, move away from here.
And they loaded up the truck.
He's like, point of vision, boom.
Where was the fuel cell first invented for? What was it first invented for? My point is, we've been working with fuel cells for so long.
It was for the space program.
Yeah, the Mercury rockets. Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Late 50s.
Right.
And we're still not there.
Oh, GM had an experimental hydrogen fuel cell van in the 1960s.
Yeah, and GM's on their fifth generation vehicle. Mercedes, yeah. GM, Mercedes, and Honda are the three manufacturers that have the most advanced fuel cell programs on Earth. But and I want to do the Hydrogen Electric Racing Federation, but it's just
It's not happening.
No.
I'll do two questions. David Schwartz asks, do you think Paul Press has a future with Chrysler? No. His name's Jim Press.
Right.
Unless,
and we'd already talked about
yes.
that.
Yeah.
Goat Rope 7 asks.
I know him.
Do you have a bad night with some Jack Daniels and a goat?
He's a longtime Auto Extremist reader.
All right.
How can GM expect to attract the brightest engineers coming out of school today, given their financial and ownership condition? They are currently talent repellent.
Well, that's not just a GM problem or a government-owned car company problem. It's a auto industry problem right now.
Right, not just Detroit.
Yeah, not just Detroit. It's attracting people. The design talent, it's easy to attract.
Yeah.
But the engineers and that, because, Jason, you mentioned this a while ago. Back at one point, it was really cool for a young engineer. But subsequently, we have the computer thing, and it's changed, and it's very difficult to get them to sign.
One area where we are seeing some interest is quote unquote cool green cars,
right.
Advanced battery stuff, all
right,
that.
Right. We
can bring some of the best in.
Yeah, we might see I hope we see a spike back up in right. the
I do too. The problem yep. is we have a state that is in a one-state depression, and the kids want to leave here. And so there has to be an overall effort beyond these pure Michigan ads that talk about our beaches, because the kids that live here know the beaches, and it's the economic climate. So that has to change. The next question, when will Roger Penske be on the show? And this is from Roger Penske. No, from GX Racer.
You know, we can try to get Roger. He called me last week to take me through the Saturn thing personally, so he said if I need anything, call him. So maybe I'll just call him and say.
Well, you call him. I can't get him on the show.
Okay.
This is from Mitch Weaver. Is the small car technology Fiat is bringing into Chrysler going to be a couple of cycles stale by the time any car is on sale? It's a very good question. We were talking on the show about Nissan's problems in the late 90s of launching a car in Japan and waiting 18 to 24 months before they launched in the U.S. or Europe, and it was already stale. The 500, he says, has been out for a few years now.
That's a good point. I mean, obviously, they've got some newer generation stuff that we aren't privy to. I would hope they would just skip to that.
Right.
I remember back when I, about halfway through the first decade of Auto Extremist, the first decade, I said, you know, too often in the Detroit car makers would sit there and, you know, do this next generation thing. And you'd see it and you'd always say, you know what, guys, just skip that. That's good. But just go on to the next stuff, because that'll, you know, that's the only way you're going to get, you know, get the American consumer's attention. And that's a good question, because if Fiat comes in with stale stuff, it's not going to work.
No, it's not. But all I'll say is that, yeah, the 500's a couple of years old. Nobody in this country has seen it.
Yeah.
The 159 just came out in Europe. By the time it gets here, still.
You know, there's
yellow.
The 500 in town. And when you see it, it's just like, that's cool. I saw it at the Paris show, but and on the street in Paris, which is just like very cool. But when you see it driving around in Oakland County, it's just like, hey, that's cool.
Yeah.
I had a good question here, and now that I've lost it. Oh, good. Victor Alleman asks, where do you think Fiat will produce its future Chrysler badge vehicles?
Jason?
I know that Sterling Heights is making a push to keep the plant open, and I think politically correct Fiat Chrysler should keep one of those plants open, because it's a foreign-owned company, and they could have a lot of goodwill. It's a decent plant, too. It's fairly modern, so I think they're smart if they do that. How will they badge Chrysler Fiat vehicles? Same gentleman.
Well, if I bring in the 500, I'm going to call it the 500.
Yeah, it's got to be
the Fiat 500.
Yeah.
And if it's an Alpha 159, it's an Alpha.
I mean,
now, what Chrysler needs to do is take Fiat architecture and componentry and design its own versions of it. So, all the pickup points for the suspension, the steering, and the powertrain, blah, 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 all those are the same. But the thing should look like a Chrysler. Ralph Gilles should be overseeing how those products look.
Right.
Okay, can we end with this last one? And I have it here.
Yeah.
And what a way to end, considering they ended this week. This is from Jonathan John Nathan Willis on Twitter asks, with the bankruptcy slash sale of Chrysler, what happens to Cerberus? Did they lose everything?
They lost everything.
It was the biggest defeat in their company's history.
But here's what I'm told, too, is I think Marianne Keller was the one who told me this, too. Of the $7.5 billion that they put into it, only $1 billion was their money.
Absolutely.
The rest of it was other people that they got to go in on
OPMs.
The deal. So, I mean, it's bad enough to say I lost $1 billion. But it's a whole lot better than saying I lost $7.5 billion. But the long story short is these guys had their heads handed to them.
Well, one interesting thing, and I haven't seen the details, did Fiat get all the buildings back? Because Cerberus had sold all of the buildings, almost all of the buildings of Chrysler, including headquarters and a lot of the plants, to an organization called Auburn Hills Owners LLC. This is all in the Wall Street Journal. I'm not reporting it right now, which has the same address in New York that Cerberus does. So they had all these assets. Now, I heard the headquarters went with Fiat, so they relinquished that. But I don't know if they relinquished everything and if they still have some.
Doesn't matter. I mean, who owns the mortgage of your house these days? You don't even know that. It gets sold and sold and sold. Does it matter who owns the building?
Tony.
Yeah. I don't think it matters who owns the buildings.
No, it does. If Cerberus still owns the buildings that they're going to produce stuff in, they'll have to charge rent to Chrysler Fiat, so they could be a moneymaker. But I don't know the details.
Somehow,
the Wall Street Journal broke this a couple months ago.
Somehow, I think they worked that out.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, and Cerberus still has its mitts into GMAC, doesn't it?
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean,
they've lost a big portion
called,
of the government.
Right.
It's called Ally.
Yeah. And Chrysler
when
Financial
it,
is...
When I first saw it, I thought it said Ally. Ally Bank? No, it was Ally. Oh, okay. Huh.
Well, hopefully next week will be a little more boring for the auto industry and they can just get on with making cars.
Well, next week we're going to have Mark LaNave here. So
in
that's going to be a good show. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. So, but let's wrap up here because we should go home. Tomorrow's another day.
Lakers hopefully get beat tonight by Orlando. Tigers are playing the White Sox.
And so, the Red Wings.
The Red Wings tomorrow night.
God, they have to do it. We need it bad.
Yep. God is on our side.
Yeah. So, again, folks, thanks for tuning in. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/autoline. Follow Peter at twitter.com/autoextremist. And we forgot to mention this. I wanted to ask John Mandel about this. Twitter.com/Alicia_@_Honda. And you can follow Honda on Twitter at that. But thanks so much for watching. And thanks you guys again for coming on in.
Glad to be here.
Jed, move away from here.
The litter of the truck and the Beverly Hills, that is.
Texas tea. Black gold.
Visit our website, OuterLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Outerline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Outerline Detroit. That's all there and much more at OuterLineDetroit.tv.